The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning. Oh, yeah, it's afternoon.
Darn it.
I used to say good morning. We'd say good morning for 4 years.
It's a bad habit.
It is. Yeah, good morning. Yeah, who wants to get up early anyway? Nuts to it. So you've now slipped into the We the People couple hours here. We've got some got a good guest for you today. It'd be something different, something Christmassy. And are you all situated?
I'm ready to go. I'm fired up and fighting.
Bill's like,
my microphone sounds a little off, though.
A little. No, it's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. Let's give everybody the particulars. Okay, the website is wethepeopleradio.us. You're like panting over there.
I am. Yeah. I'll tell you, it's the microphone.
Okay, that was pretty funny.
It's you getting me here. It's you getting me here late.
Okay,
okay, we have to go 5 minutes
ago. Those stalking noises in the background, those are just free. Oh, my gosh. So,
I'm ready to kill my buddy.
Yeah. Come on, Sling Blade, get with it. So much for the Christmas show. Okay, so you can reach us at wethepeopleradio.us. All our information is on there. You can call in at 530-605-4567. And we're on every Sunday from noon to 2. How's that? And the archives, if you go to the KCNR webpage, the archives start like a week ago, week and a half ago, because it blew them all off when we switched times. But the website has them all the way back to 2010. So if you're looking for, you know, all the different programs we've done on, you know, all the environmental issues and, I don't know, anything you could possibly think of.
Well, check out the website because it is cool now. You made a lot of changes to it.
I did make a lot of changes. And if it comes up funky or, you know, it's hard to work or something like that, email, phone number, all that stuff is on there. And please be not afraid to say anything. All right. How are we doing? We've got Bill in there.
We've got Horse Creek Mike in the chat room. And
did he make the chat room? Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. The chat room is open, by the way. So,
but you're talking about the other Bill.
I know. We have two Bills this morning, which is fun. So it's Aaron, Bob, Bill, and Bill this morning. And if you go to the webpage, you will see a click to listen and join the chat room. I don't know. It's a button, but it's really long. It's like I made a 7-inch button. You can't miss it. And you click that, it'll pop you right up to the chat. You can take questions that way, or you could talk about other things, which is usually what happens for our multitasking listeners.
Or you can call in.
Or you could call in. There's that.
Yeah, what's that number? Did you already give it?
I did.
Oh, okay.
Where were you?
I was...
Were you breathing into the microphone? afternoon show, you know. We were, like, in the morning, we were kind of more focused. So...
You're lying now.
Bill's like, why did I agree to do this program? These people are completely nutty.
Yeah, there's no
the heck
focus
am I doing? This
all.
Is going to destroy my reputation. Okay, but you do audiobooks. So Bill, you appreciate some good, like, you know, sound effects in the background and stuff like that, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm expecting all kinds of Foley from you guys. I hear some already. Is the laughter real, or are those sound effects?
It's pitiful laughter.
It's pitiful laughter. We laugh at ourselves.
You guys are crazy.
It's true. We laugh at ourselves because we know the other people are, and they think they're getting away with something, and we just want to steal it from them.
It's like you're racing out in front to get there first.
Something like that, which is probably why people don't call in. They're like, I don't know, it's probably not safe.
They don't want to get hurt.
Gosh. Although we did get a fun Christmas card the other day, and thanks for that. So for, let's see, Lydia and Harold, who, you know, it's funny, when people send you their family Christmas letter, you get to find out all sorts of things about them.
Yeah.
His name is really Lowell. That was a little news flash there.
I'm like, did not know that.
She went on a trip with Lowell. Who's Lowell?
Yeah, what the hell happened
to
Harold?
Lowell is Harold.
Yeah.
So keep the cards coming there. We love them.
Yeah, we do. We got a lot of nice cards.
We did.
Yeah.
All right. So back to Bill Hyde. Okay, you've done this audiobook. Is it out now, the book In Freedom's Cause?
It is out. It was out about the 1st of November, and it was our second audio drama, or audio movie, as we call it.
Oh, there you go. I really liked, there was a quote, kind of, there are a lot of good things on your website, and people can get there by clicking through any of our links, but there was one really good quote that somebody wrote because they were interviewing you, and it was a quote from you where you said, "What we're trying to do is put faith back into history. Everything in our world is sort of sterilized and secularized, and the faith of men has been taken out of textbooks in America and around the world. These projects are all about putting Christ back into history." And I thought, oh my gosh, how many people would be happy about that? Tons.
Absolutely.
Yeah, some would be happy and some would be sad, maybe. But
they don't listen to our show.
Well, they did. They would be happy.
Therefore, we don't care about them. So tell me the name of the other one. It's Under Drake's Flag. Is that the whole?
It's about one of my great, great heroes, Sir Francis Drake, and it's called Under Drake's Flag.
Okay.
And it's about his life and about him, some exploits of his and the circumnavigation of the earth is one of the things that he's doing. But this story's about just what's going on in the Caribbean. And oddly enough, guys, it has everything to do with our freedom and the place that we live, too. And I'll just tell you a little bit about that before we go into the other one. The Pope, Alexander the 10th, was it? I can't remember. He had given North America to the Spaniards, and so all of North America was Spain's property. And, of course, if you remember, at the time they had the Armada, which was probably the equivalent of the United States Navy today, which is the most powerful force, naval force in the world. That 100 big Spanish galleons, and they basically ruled that area. Well, Sir Francis Drake almost single-handedly cut that strength and just pretty much destroyed the Armada. And that had significance not only as far as trade was concerned in England and around Europe, but also over here because this was Spanish ground. And then that set the way for the settlement at Augustine, Florida, and the later Jamestown. And you move up the line with the Pilgrims and so forth later on. So take away Sir Francis Drake, you don't get George Washington very easily. And those two men were a lot alike in terms of their discipline, their faith, and just solid believers. And it shows up in their life. It shows up how they do business, shows up how they sail, shows up how they lead their men and so forth. So we are trying to put Christ back in, and I really find it almost repulsive when cheesy Christianity is done and we find things, faith, put into places where it really wasn't or put in. It's quite awkward. But what we've done is try to do a lot of research to try to really get below the surface and find some maybe books that haven't really been looked at and find out who these people really were and then cut through the fog of all of the, as we say, the, you know, sanitization and all of the removal, the surgical removal of Christ from history and try to present characters in history as they really were.
That's pretty cool because people are upset that history is basically being rewritten, and that's a facet of it that I don't, like, I've been on Sir Francis Drake's ship. I don't remember where we were, but anyway, it was visiting that port.
Wow, you're really old.
I know, I am. I was. No, see, that's when I say I was on it. Yeah. I was a stowaway. Because I was late.
You were probably on a replica in London. I was of the Golden Hind, which I have been as well, and it's a really cool experience.
It was. I think it might have been in the port over in Eureka. At some point, I remember taking my kids on it. But I grew up in the East, and, you know, we learned about all these guys, but I didn't know anything behind Sir Francis Drake after all that. That was my point. Was I missed all that, too. They'd already taken it all out, and I'm, what, 53? When did they start peeling all that stuff out of our history?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. I would say that really you have to go to find old history books if you want to kind of find some gems about the heroes that we're making reference to. You got to go before the Civil War. I think Lincoln had a lot to do with our country changing, I'm not throwing all the blame on old Abe. I'm talking to you from Illinois. So the Lincoln-Douglas debates were done not too far from where I'm sitting right now. But I'd say probably the Civil War really was when history got rewritten. A lot of things. It's like Wikipedia. You know, you go in and change a couple things, and you might as well change a lot of things, right? So history was really rewritten after the Civil War.
That's cool. And so who you tell us a little bit about yourself, because you use these for school, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm interested in this kind of thing personally. So that, I think, is what drives my passion to try to bring history to life. And these books are based on novels that were written by the Victorian writer G.A. Henty. And my son had read these books when he was in 7th and 8th grade. He started picking these books up, and he started to devour them. And as a parent, I was always looking for the kind of reading material that wasn't necessarily politically correct and that had history maybe stepped on, as we're saying. And Henty provided that. Henty was, as a Victorian, he had written his books before postmodernity, right? So, I mean, he didn't really know anything about trying to say, like Pontius Pilate, what is truth. To him, as a Victorian, there was a right and wrong. There was a great life. There was adventure. There were heroes. Yes, they were flawed. That's what makes them heroes, because they were flawed. And he just portrayed his heroes. He always took a couple of boys and a girl, and they went on a journey with some famous person, with a real hero, not somebody that can dunk a basketball or sing a note or something or drive a car fast, but people that I think are real heroes. And his writing just is most profound, and it moves along quickly. So there's a nice combination of things that I saw as a parent years and years and years ago, that I wanted these for my own kids. I wanted my own family to read these books. Then we had the opportunity to try to say, okay, how can we bring history to life if we're going to do some audio dramas, audio movies? What's going to be the basis for our storytelling? And we said, let's try G.A. Henty. He's got so much to offer kids of today because of the way he looks at life. There's always an adventure. And so, guys, you got kids right now, as we're sitting here, probably most kids in this country are in front of a screen of some type now, playing a game, calling someone, texting someone. What I love about Henty is sun and wind and surf and rain and temperature in your face, outside, adventures, living a real life and not a virtual one. So I know that's a long answer. A lot of my answers are long.
No,
but
that's okay.
That's the context.
That makes sense, though. And kids like to read. I mean, my mom, I think she was the one who really got us hooked on biographies and stories that were true, because I think it was her dad that he would always read anything that was about somebody's life. And I don't know that our kids really grow up with that now. A lot of biographical information.
Well, they've taken so much of it out of history, so there's really no reference.
Yeah, maybe that's it. And we don't go to those places. We don't do a lot of museums, and depending on where you live, there might not be very many. You have curriculum that goes with this, too, don't you?
Yeah, we do. We have almost 50 pages of curriculum that goes with this, where parents can engage their kids with words that maybe they're not familiar with, but interesting vocab words that we kind of brought along for the ride, and ways to engage kids with moral choices along the way. I'll give you an example. Back in under Drake's flag, when Sir Francis Drake first starts sailing, he starts sailing with his cousin John Hawkins, and the Hawkins family thought they could make a lot of money in the slavery business. And so young Francis Drake had his first job opportunity on a slave boat. He did a couple of these slave runs, and he said to himself, I can't do this. And he made a moral choice, and we can all make moral choices, and said, I'm not, you know, these are human beings, I'm not in them. His dad was a lay preacher and preached out of the book of Romans to the kids in his family, all 12 of them, his brothers and sisters were 11, he made 12, and his dad made a solid impression on him, and that impression and that sort of the framework that he had for living that his dad inculcated into him gave him a way to respond to life later on. He said, I can't do slavery. So he changed his way of figuring out how he's going to do his life. So there's a lot of moral lessons, and we kind of bring these things out in the curriculum. And what we like to do is give parents the opportunity to maybe stop the player or something and engage their kids or wait for it's over, wait till a certain section's over and engage their kids with a great idea. What would you do if this happened to you? What would you do if you ran out of food and you're trying to circumnavigate the earth? How do you have the faith to keep going? Do you quit? What do you do? Does your faith fall apart under a little stress and all of that? And that's in both in Freedom's Cause as well as under Drake's Flight.
What's been the reception from parents? Have you gotten much feedback from parents about what you're doing?
Well, I got to tell you, the other day I got feedback from a kind of a well-known parent. I was in Atlanta and my plane landed, and we all check our emails because I run a business and I've always got problems. And so on my plane lands at the Atlanta airport, and we're waiting for the jet bridge to move out and all of that. And I find a text from Kirk Cameron that said, your work is awesome, and my son can't wait for the next one. So that's when you cool. get emails like that from parents, whether they're Glenn Beck or Kirk Cameron or just ordinary people like I assume you and I are, you know, normal people, mortals,
just it really tickles folks.
Me because, we feel like if we could make a little difference, that's kind of, you know, that's it. And we don't really have much more in life to have a few people say, hey, this really had an effect on my family, and we talked about it. Love your characters. We loved how you interact with the story. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That
I mean, because for everyone that said, you know, took the time to let you know the impact you're having, think of the ones that didn't say anything that have been
sure.
impacted. I mean, there's probably a whole lot more of them. So, that's a good feeling.
That is very cool. All right. We have to do a checkup here. Where are we, Bob, in the sequence of, you said we run a business here, and that prompted me. We have Todd hostage on the phone. And
indeed.
And I know we have a break coming, so what do we have to do, Bob? You be the boss of us.
Okay, we've got time for Todd, and then we'll break at the bottom of the hour.
Outstanding. See, it's working out for Todd already. Todd's got a question for Bill Hyde.
Hi, Todd.
Fire away, Todd.
Yeah. Say I had a question about history and how government was formed, and I was hoping that your guest would be able to answer it. South America's the people's rights come from the government. The government owned all the land versus North America, where your rights come from your creator. And I was wondering if he had any insight to that history of how the two, North America versus South America, and how the governments are different.
Wow, how much time do I get on that one?
Yeah.
Well, we have an hour and a half left, barring...
I mean, right now, do we want to tackle that, or do you have to go to a break? Because that's a really great question.
That is a really great question. How about that, Bob? Do a little break, thank our advertisers. Todd, do you want to hang with us?
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Do you want to...
Do you want to hang through the break, or... You wanted to answer on there.
How about this, Todd? If you hang up, I bet you'll be able to hear it better on your computer, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, and then if we don't answer it, either call us back or shoot us a message in the chat room. How'd that be?
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Have a great day up there in Crescent Mills. All right.
You've been listening to We the People for the last half hour. I think we finally hit our stride. We're here with Bill Hyde. He has, he's going to tell us about In Freedom's Cause, the real story behind Wallace and Bruce in the story we know as Braveheart.
We'll be back.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? Oh,
good one.
Who's that? Christopher Cross?
Coldplay.
Coldplay.
Coldplay. That was a good one. You know, we always put Bob through his paces. I wondered what he was going to pick for music for today. This was a kind of a tall order. We are being joined. Well, I guess a historical order, maybe. We're being joined by Bill Hyde. He's a businessman, an entrepreneur, and a historian who founded Heirloom Audio out of a desire to give children positive, Christ-centered entertainment that not only engages the mind, but educates and inspires. And the latest work is In Freedom's Cause, which is really, I think it was Brandon who told me that you guys call it the God story behind Braveheart. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah, that's one way of saying it's, you know, maybe a better way of saying it. It's the real story, because sometimes I get nervous if we say, hey, there's this compartmentalized God story, and then again, there's real history. So, this is the real story, because all of history is God's story. That's what motivates and animates us because of that. So, yeah, we like to think we've got some of the real backstory behind Braveheart. Did a lot of research to try to find out what this guy William Wallace was really like. And listen, guys, Wallace. So much of Wallace's outlook on history and life has everything to do with Todd's question. I mean, there really is a strong connection to these things.
Yeah. So where do you want to go with that? Maybe. Why don't you reiterate his question as you heard it? Because that's what you're going to answer.
Well, he was mainly saying, and this is, he was hinting around at how theology interacts with politics, basically, because in South America you had largely very high church colonization, and in North America you had a little bit of a high church colonization, but you had folks that were coming over here a little bit maybe angry with that, or a little bit, they called themselves separatists, right, or independents, and they didn't like high church. You remember James the First? This is a fascinating thing. Let me try to connect it with Wallace a little bit, and we'll go back to it. But, you know, Wallace kind of believed that there were covenants, and covenants that nobles were in covenant with the people inside their districts, and then the nobles were in covenant to kings and so forth, that there was a hierarchical structure, but it had representative government built into it, because everyone was almost in a feudal sense accountable going frontwards and backwards. If you go to in many cases the Catholic interpretation, that there wasn't a lot of representation along the way up. In other words, something got handed down from way, way up on top, and there wasn't a lot of room for the representative side. If you look at the pilgrims, they very much were running from James the First. James the First was a high church a guy who wanted a lot of power, but he was a very smart man, and he said something that has stuck with me since I've studied him years ago. He said, no bishop, no king. And that sounds like, what the heck's he talking about? No bishop, no king. What he meant was, without hierarchical power in the church, there's no hierarchical power politically for the king.
Okay.
Wow. So enter Bradford and Brewster. Now, these guys were separatists. These guys were congregationalists. And baked into congregationalism was this idea of representative government inside church polity, right? So they come over to this country. They're being chased around. Remember, they're trying to... James and the other people aren't nice guys. They're trying to cut off their ears and split their nose and burn them and throw them in jail and all of these other things. So it's not a very polite situation. They were being persecuted by high church English. And so they came here to this country. Remember, they decided before they even got out of the water, they decided, we want to have some kind of compact or covenant. This was back to Wallace's time, right? We want to have a covenant, Mayflower Covenant, before we even get out of a boat. Let's agree how we're going to treat each other, why we're here, who's authoritative, and all of these great questions that are political questions that Todd was hinting at. All of these questions kind of have representatives in it. So you got Elder Brewster, if you remember. We don't have the popes and bishops that hand down decrees in this case. And so you've got these folks landing. What happens to the rest of the colonies, in my interpretation, is the English get busy. There's charters. They're Christian-based charters. You can go read those charters anytime you want. In the name of God, amen. All of those charters that govern the original colonizations have that function. But these guys get left to govern themselves because they're a long ways from home by intention, in the Pilgrim's case, and they have to figure out how to govern themselves. So they begin to govern themselves, guys, very much the way they did their church polity. Well, how do you decide something in a congregational Presbyterian church? Is it just a sign from one person from the top? Or do you have elders and do you have deacons? And there's this whole idea of representation. That's a long answer to Todd, but you just get something different with a Presbyterian / congregationalist motif than you do with a top down religious order. That's not to say that there weren't a lot of great Catholics, and I'm not trying to tread down on that water, but I'm telling you what I really feel is at the root of both religious and political freedom.
Well, then didn't the American Revolution, didn't that kind of put the icing on the cake? I mean, politically, it kind of did that separation?
Oh, without a doubt. One thing that the founders, we fast forward from the time that I'm talking about these really strong Christians and the structure in place for Christian government probably exists in the colonies. By the time you get to our Revolutionary War, you do have that, and you have people, that same thing that was baked into the original DNA of Virginia, Massachusetts, and so forth. They said, one thing we don't want are Anglican bishops. And that's another thing that's been sanitized and taken out of all the textbooks, but that was one of the leading issues of the day. Do we get the Anglican bishops, and do we have to submit ourselves? All of these colonies had their own representation. Maryland was Catholic, and you just had different view. Rhode Island was maybe a little more Baptist, and you had very strong religious natures of the colonies. And all they basically said is, at the founding of our country, was the federal government isn't going to establish any kind of Anglicanism or Catholicism or Presbyterianism over all of the colonies. And so this whole church-state thing has really been misunderstood, because it's in that context that they said there should be a wall. Yeah, should there be a wall, but it's only we don't want denominationalism. It's not that we're not living in a Christian country. And I think if you read the surrounding documents, you guys have been through that before, not telling anything new, it is essentially a very Christian country at its founding.
Sure, and people, they throw that up. They created the separation of church and state, but they forget that it was a freedom to choose your own religion, not a freedom from religion necessarily. Prohibition of religion, I guess, maybe is a better term.
And there were some very religious things that happened. I'll tell you one thing that most people don't know. It's a little far away from William Wallace, but when Thomas Jefferson was governor of Virginia, he tried to sell 63,000 acres, take the money, and buy John Calvin's school, the Geneva School. John Calvin long dead, but the Geneva school was in disarray in Switzerland. And Jefferson tried to buy this Calvinistic school and bring the thing into our country. All the books, the buildings would stay there, but all the teachers and everything. He tried to do that himself by selling public lands in Virginia to do something very religious. And people don't realize the nature of this wall. And I don't think there's anybody that's listening to this would say we don't want a wall, because we'd rather have a Catholic United States or an Orthodox Presbyterian United States or something. None of us want that. But we do, at least in my case, I want a Christian United States because I think that's where freedom comes from. I don't think you can get freedom with atheistic materialism. I don't think that it comes that you could find freedom. And I described for you this relationship covenantally, how representative government is formed, and so forth. I don't think you get that from other types of belief systems.
No. But didn't our president say that we aren't a Christian-based country?
I don't think you get that from other belief systems. Yeah, he would represent a very foreign belief system.
Right.
Patrick Henry probably would have a very difficult time having a discussion with Barack Obama.
as would we all.
The nature of what words mean. It's almost, it would be like the Tower of Babel in some sense.
Oh, yeah. Total opposites, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, and just really disingenuous, because if you look at, look at why the, you can get into the whole thing about where the pilgrims, you know, who was here first, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, the colonists, when they came here, they came because they wanted to practice their own religion. That was a driving force. I mean, you can't miss that historically, but have they taken that out too? I haven't read what we're pitching in recent history, Bill.
Well, you can't teach that it would be a violation of that misappropriated, wall today if you taught that people came here from England because they wanted to worship God and because they wanted to see. You don't have to look too far into the documents with a lot of the governors and so forth that people, Governor Winthrop and so forth, they wanted to build. It wasn't just that they were religious. They wanted to build a city on the hill. They had, this Augustinian dream of building a Christian civilization. That's what the intent was. And I'm not sure that they wanted to go into a prayer closet and worship. If you read the, here we're into bumpy waters again, but let's engage, because the pilgrims, very simply, were very, very, intolerant of other belief systems too, as were other belief systems. Now, if you go down to Jamestown, when Jamestown was very first established, there's some really harsh laws in terms of just how you're to live. I'm not advocating these laws, but I'm just trying to tell you how Christian the world was. It was the death penalty for missing church three times in a row.
Oh, they didn't mess around. I mean, there were rules set up, and you went by those rules, or the elders came down on you.
Yeah,
you're in stocks.
Yeah. People think Bob Jones University is tough. I mean, that's tough, right?
Oh,
jeez.
Yeah, and anybody who's seen even the Hollywood version of The Scarlet Letter might get a clue. You know, they weren't really all that tolerant.
They weren't tolerant because they thought that they had it right in some sense. Now, they were probably a little more tolerant than Hawthorne had them picked out to be in terms of burning witches and stuff. I think a lot of that may be pushed out onto, a lot of the sensationalism may be pushed out. I think a lot of folks didn't want those trials. That's probably a whole nother Sunday that we take on the witch trials and so forth. But I don't think they wanted, to be honest, I don't think they wanted witches. I don't think they wanted satanic worship.
Oh, no.
Because they didn't
see it. They were pretty hardcore about that.
Well, they didn't see it as congruent with their belief system. So for them, it would be a quite natural reaction to such things. And, of course, if Satan worshippers attain political power, they quite naturally see the worship of a Christian God as something that they become intolerant of. It's the time between we're a minority and the time that we're a majority that everyone sort of says, we won't do anything with that until we're given power. But you know what? The truth is, once a group gets in power, we're not equal anymore. People tend to react coherently and cohesively with their worldview, and they become, as we say in philosophical circles, epistemologically self-conscious. So you just become more and more of what you already are. And there's a lot of cultures that are like that, but America went a different direction, and I think the greatness that was America and can still be America in my eyes has a whole different contextual framework, and it does have the Christian religion as its base, as its foundation, as the pillars of its substructure.
Sure, regardless of what they choose to practice or not practice, I would think that the majority of people actually get that. And we hear from this weird, cranky, you know, the atheists and those guys.
Well, if you look at
the such a tiny part of our society.
Sure, but look, there's a lot of folks out there that don't believe that Islam is compatible with Christianity, you know, so it kind of gets back to the whole witch thing, you know.
We're burn them at the stake. God's a funny man, though. He's helping him out with that understanding.
It's a complex world, and all of these things, I think tolerance is an interesting subject. I think that there's a place for grace. I hope all of our listeners know and understand that there's a place of grace in our life. But when it comes to some things political, if we have to say things where it gets tough, is all laws are enacted morality. So when you start to enact laws, you begin to bring out this idea of what is the religious nature of that law? What does that law, what is it saying? Is there neutrality? There's no neutrality in the world. A law always has some type of positive reference. And then you can say, is that Christian? Is that pagan? Is that satanic? Is that, what is that? You know, Sharia law. And here, good for my Islamic friends. I don't agree with that, but good for them. They at least know that every belief system is going to have a law code behind it. So quite naturally they're going to say Sharia law. Quite naturally. The pilgrims had the same thing. The Bible was the law code of the United States. We had hundreds of courts for a long, long time into this country where you went into, there was some kind of infraction. What was the, they didn't have a lot of case law, right? What was the law? They get the Bible on, you know, Leviticus and say, what's the penalty for that? So that's the nature of the founding of our country. Whether people like that or not, it just was.
Well, we have listeners from all over, but we happen to actually currently reside in a state that just decided that tons of felonies are now going to be misdemeanors. So, so much for the law. We're not going to be pulling out Leviticus in California anytime soon. I can tell you that.
That's probably against the law, because here's why, guys. It'll be against the law, just like it's against the law to go to New York City and put a verse from Leviticus that has reference to sexual behavior. It is against the law as we speak to put that on a billboard. So who's intolerant?
Yeah,
I said when pagans get control of that, they get mad at the pilgrims if the pilgrims are in power. But when they get in power, what's the first thing they do? Create blasphemy laws, create things you can't say, create things you can't do. So This idea of neutrality really needs to be discussed, because there's no such thing.
Because it's not, it's not real.
Yeah, it doesn't exist.
I read on Twitter the other day that in 10 years' time, the people who actually know how to use the word whom correctly will probably be burned as witches. So, so for those of us who have a deep commitment to grammar and all things that, those bad apostrophes being used. Apparently,
but you also say wheat thins.
I know. Apparently they're gunning for us. All right, hit it, Bob. We will thank our advertisers. We'll give Bill a chance to probably load up on some coffee or whatever it is you do in the afternoon.
We still
got to
get the Braveheart. I mean, I'm
sorry. We got messing around.
Yeah, we're getting warmed up here.
Yeah, there you go. Good. See, that's why you got to be on the whole show, because there's too much goofing off. All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR, 1460 AM.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I love you, and I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
This is United States Navy Captain John Brigelli, forward deployed with the U.S. 7th Fleet in Yokosuka, Japan, and proudly serving in the Asia-Pacific area of operations. I want to wish my family and friends in Red Bluff, California, happy holidays. Thank you for your support, and thanks to all Americans who back the U.S. Navy.
Really wanna feel you, really wanna see you, Lord,
hear anything.
You're on.
Oh, well,
there we are.
Well, there we go. Okay, so the music's over. The fun is over. We're back.
Yeah, just cut it off right there.
So we have like we have 5 minutes, Bill. What do you want to tell us in 5 minutes? And then you're going to come back next hour. So maybe do a good lead up so everybody hangs with us through the news for Braveheart. How'd that be?
You absolutely, absolutely have to tune back in to find out what's going to go on. Here's what I'll do. I'm gonna hold my breath. Yeah. After the break, if I live through, after the break to see if Bill lives through this major event.
Come on, you're supposed to say you got a special suit and you're gonna be eaten by a giant anaconda.
I'd love it. Where do you get those suits anyway? Because I've looked all over.
Well, apparently it just doesn't protect your head that well. Apparently, once that gets in there, it gets a little too squeezy.
Yeah, they want you to sign all kinds of waivers when you buy those suits. So I never know what to do.
And then
I need help, as you know.
And then they send your information to PETA, and they begin stalking you, and that's a whole different form of history.
He's stalking an anaconda from within.
I don't really like David Letterman for many reasons, but. You know, he can be kind of funny, and I don't know how. I think I was just up late one night, and I happened to click it on, and he
was ripping him.
He was on a rant about the guy in the anaconda suit. I'm sure it's on YouTube, and actually, it was hilarious.
Yeah, well, he was mad because he was waiting for that episode because he really wanted to see this guy getting eaten.
He put it on his calendar and everything.
He gets the top of his head in there, and he's out.
He did like the top 10 on something about getting eaten by an anaconda. It was actually really funny.
Did the guy actually get eaten by an anaconda?
No, seriously, no. He put his head in there and it was too tight, so he was like, pull me out. He panicked.
Yeah, he got like just about to his neck.
But the part that Letterman was so frosted about was apparently the show was taped 2 weeks before it aired. And so Discovery Channel already knew that it was phony, and they kept promoting it for 2 weeks to the big build-up, and it was like Al Capone's safe with Geraldo, right?
Geraldo's greatest moment.
Yeah, nothing in there. So anyway,
yep.
That reminded me of that. Well, we digress.
We digress, yeah.
Imagine that.
Imagine it happened again. Dang it. Okay, so I've got the link on there. What's the best? Is it infreedomscause.com? It's the best place to go to find the audiobook and all the stuff about it.
Yeah, infreedomscause.com. There's a lot of free stuff on there. You can go watch behind the scenes trailers. We got a lot of stars in this one.
Oh yeah, tell us about the guys. Who's the guy? The British kind of guy, the narrator.
Brian Blessed.
And he's awesome, and everybody knows his voice. But when I heard his voice, I thought, oh, I know that guy. But why?
Brian's a very famous star in England, and he's been in a lot of productions, Les Miserables. I mean, if you go to England, he's everyone, or if I find somebody from England that comes over here and I'm in an airport and I'm talking to somebody, I ask if they know Brian Blessed. I've never talked to somebody from England that doesn't know who Brian is. He's an unbelievable talent and an unbelievable human being as an adventurer. One time he was climbing, Mount Everest, and he's a little older now, but one time he was climbing Mount Everest and he had something happen to someone that was with him. I don't know if it was one of the Sherpas or whoever, but he's an indomitable fellow, and he carried his partner or Sherpa or whoever on his shoulder all the way back down as far as he could. And so his life is full of adventure. We chose him to be our G.A. Henty just because their lives were so close in nature. They lead big lives. They're not afraid of doing big things. And Henty was a great adventurer, went around the world. And Brian's very much the same way. The last time I was talking to Brian Blessed in the parking lot of Sound Design Studio in London, I said, well, what are you going to do now? And he said, Richard Branson's going to send me into blanking space. So that was the next thing that was going to happen to Brian when I left. And I don't know whether Brian's gone into space or not with Richard, but that's the kind of thing that he does.
That is cool because I was looking at your cast of characters and I thought, man, this audiobook, well, people are listening. They'll be like, hey, that's a guy from over here and that's a lady from over there. You really pulled out all the stops.
Yeah, thank you. And you're mentioning the lady, Joanne Frog from Downton Abbey, who's up for a big-time award, Golden Globe or whatever it is. I don't even know the name of the award, but she's up for something big and just sent us a tweet the other day and kind of thanked us. And she loved being in the studio doing these parts. I mean, I think a lot of these actors, if they see a good script and they can come in the studio and irrespective of how high up on the chain, food chain they are as actors or actresses.
Oh, yeah, because you're the kid from Chronicles of Narnia.
Deep in their heart, they really want to do good work and have a lot of fun. Yeah.
That's why we like them when they're in the other things. We're going to come back. Bill's going to be holding his breath. We got Bill Hyde with us as our hostage in Illinois there. He'll be back with us in 5 minutes. We're going to learn more about the story behind Braveheart.
Braveheart.
Hit it, Bob.
Oh, yeah. Hour two of We the People is next on KCNR Deseret.
Welcome back. You have rejoined the second hour of We the People Radio. Let's see, we should give you the phone number because we forget about that all the time. So if you don't listen at the beginning, forget it. Get out. It's 530-605-4567. And the website is wethepeopleradio.us. We have everything about our guest, how to get the audiobooks, how to, you know, maybe send that information to other. I know lots of you live in different countries. You live in different states. If you'd like to have Bill Hyde on, I think you should forward that to your local station and have him on. Brandon does all the booking, and he is foolproof. Tell you what, man, that guy, he even called me at 6 o'clock in the morning one day because he had meetings that day. And see, it's a good thing he did. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing this.
That's right.
So, Bill, you still in there? Oh, Bob, you got to turn the sound back up. There we go.
Oh, he made it.
Wow.
Whoa.
That was a very difficult 5 minutes. But,
he's been holding his breath all through the news.
I feel stronger and more empowered now. Actually.
Oh, yeah.
Like the oxygen that I had in my lungs.
I bet you saw the light, didn't you?
More valuable. Yes, a lot of different lights came on. And then went back off.
And they went back off. There was that moment with the tunnel and all that.
Yeah.
That was different.
Highly overrated.
Abraham Lincoln comes. I'll done all my work.
Abraham Lincoln told me to come back. Actually, that'd be a great title for a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, or not.
Me and Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln told me to come back. Hey, when you do that audiobook, give us a call because we want to promo it.
Okay, sure. Maybe you guys can be characters in my. Do you want to be Abraham? Aaron, do you want to be Abraham Lincoln's crazy wife?
Yes. I don't know why you'd think that would be a good fit for me.
I don't know. I'm a cast. Maybe at heart, I'm really a casting director. Yeah.
It's true too. Oh my gosh! If she was kind of fun, if she could make her own fun, I guess that's what qualifies as crazy, huh?
Yeah.
I make my own fun all the time.
Think about it. Just think about what this guy now. I'm not going to step out and say that I agree with everything that Abe believed. I do think Abe was a great man in many, many ways. He had to do things that others could never do. And as a person in history, I know my friend Tom Woods has written books about him and stuff. And there's a lot of revisionist stuff on Lincoln. And I understand all that. But I'm just saying, from a spiritual side, from a personal side, who could step in Lincoln's shoes? So anybody that's a listener, whether you like Lincoln, don't like him, think about stepping into his shoes and how heartbroken this man was trying to run the country. And, man, he's still a human being. And I don't know how he did it, to be candid.
No, I don't know how you look at his life. He was like destined not to be the president. You know, he would have been voted most likely not.
Yeah. If you read some of his writings, though, my goodness, that guy was a thinker. Just amazing if you read what he wrote about what was going on at that time. It was amazing.
But what a responsibility.
Yeah, and you know, I'll never forget one of his quotes reading. You guys might appreciate this because it goes back to history and it goes back to church. And a lot of people, listeners, don't go to church. And sometimes there's a good reason to not go to church because the people at church are crazy too. And one time, Lincoln got out of church and he got up to get on the carriage, and he got on the carriage with his driver. And the driver said to him, what did you think of the sermon today, Mr. Lincoln? And his driver said to him, and he looked back and said, not much. And the guy said, why? And he said, because he didn't ask us to do anything.
Mm, good point.
So he got the fact that the book of James, and a lot of us, I've mentioned the Catholics, I'll berate my Protestant friends as well. A lot of Protestants have cut the book of James out of their Bible, and my Catholic friends always remind them that there's things to be done. And the book of James is full of those things, and those include political things, they include all kinds of things. But Lincoln somehow, my point is, knew that from the gut. He knew that if we're going to be on this planet, there's things that we should do, that we need to kick butt, that we need to try as hard as we can at everything we do. And that's what I love about that man.
I think that's a really good point. That if it doesn't turn around to doing something, really that knowledge isn't really all that useful. Talk to us about Mr. Wallace and and actually probably more specifically Robert the Bruce, because in the movie, which is how a lot of us know these characters, Robert the Bruce, he was like the one guy, if you could just get him in the woodshed alone. You know,
he's classic. He wanted to do the right thing, but he was a chicken.
So in real life, what was his deal?
Robert the Bruce.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Robert the Bruce would be like a Senate Republican today. I'll just give you an example, and President Obama would have maybe some legislation that he would say that would be idealistically, theologically, philosophically contrary to what this ostensible senatorial Republican would, they'd be at odds with each other. But this guy also knows, this Republican also knows where the pork can end up coming from. And so he always tends to, you know, as Bob Dole described politics being the art of compromise, he always compromises and he understands for himself. Because he always sees the goodies, and sometimes those goodies are for the people that vote for you, but they always see those goodies on the other side. In Robert the Bruce's case, Longshanks, he was a tough warrior, and Longshanks actually, he was one of his favored knights. So he was very close to the king in that sense, and Wallace saw the encroachment from Longshanks from more of the people's perspective. Wallace was a noble son himself, but at a much lower category, and he saw it from the people's standpoint, whereas Robert the Bruce, both in real life and maybe a little bit of the Braveheart story, was just someone that had too much to lose, and he had too much to gain by staying in good favor of the king. But I guess the part of the story that I like the most is William Wallace says, okay, and this is back to that representative government thing that we were talking about early. Wallace is a reluctant warrior. Wallace does not want to lead this king. First of all, it's not his place in how their clannish and covenantal society is structured. But he keeps working at the nobles. He keeps working at the people who are his lesser magistrate. I guess if you look at the book of Romans, it says, it talks about being under the lesser magistrate. Who's your lesser magistrate? In Wallace's case, it was the nobles. He couldn't get them to see, and he couldn't get them to react. And there was so much political intrigue going on, one family against another family, that it was part of this whole mess. And so they just couldn't get agreement that it was Scotland and the people that they were really representing. And so Wallace said, okay, as a reluctant warrior going into Stirling Bridge, okay, I'll do this thing. And of course we find in both Wallace's, in the story of Wallace's real life as well as, our friend Mel Gibson's story, we find that Wallace really is an able leader. He really is able to, get people together, get them to fight for a common purpose. And it's the purpose that I just mentioned. It's Scotland. It's the people. It's your family. It's your land. And that's how he rallies people, and that's how he wins that first battle. And later, of course, Falkirk, we lose Wallace loses, and he kind of goes into exile. A lot of stories about where Wallace goes after that. But all of the time Robert the Bruce is watching, all the time that Robert the Bruce is maybe even engaged on some little lesser battles with Longshanks that not too many people talk about, but not really full bore, not fully engaged. And it's only after Wallace's death, I think, that we get Robert the Bruce, where he's reflecting on this whole thing, and he comes back and says, you know what, I've been a schmuck, like you guys are saying. If you go to the Bannockburn Center in Scotland, there's a little coffee cup, and I brought one back with me, and that little coffee cup's got a spider web on it, and a spider. Everyone goes, what's that all about? Well, the story is, the legend is, after some battles were lost, he was chased all over Scotland, and he ends up on the coast, and he ends up in a cave, and all his riches and all his wealth, and then and all of his kind of cowtailing to the king ended up not really helping him, and now he's an outcast, kind of like a David, kind of like William Wallace was himself, being chased around with no help. Every day he sees this little spider, and the wind and the surf from the ocean, the cave, blow this little spider's web down, and he's hiding in this cave, and every day he sees this spider rebuild this web after the wind and the surf and everything destroys it. Eventually he says to himself, no more. So he looks at Wallace, the world, the guts that Wallace had, and he says, I'm in. I made a mistake, but I'm back. And I think I really appreciate Robert the Bruce as much as I appreciate Wallace, because I'm a sinner too. I can be a gutless weasel too. And when I see someone that changes and comes around and does the right thing in the end, that's the only thing I'm interested in. I'm just interested in who ends up taking a stand. And it took all of these other circumstances to show him that he had been a coward, to show him that it was the people from Scotland that he was in charge of, and he was their representative, and their he was responsible for them, and he had a duty. And of course we know what happens next. They go to Bannockburn, and one of the biggest defeats ever, kind of, if you look back, some people would say Bannockburn is one of the greatest military victories ever won, and it showed that a small power can turn away a big power. And after Bannockburn, you have this wonderful document that a lot of Americans are unaware of, but I would try to say to the listeners, go to Google or Yahoo or whatever it is, and type in the Treaty of Arbroath. The Treaty of Arbroath, 1320.
How do you spell it?
I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's A-R-B-R-O-A-T-H. Arbroath.
Mm-hmm.
So if you type in Arbroath, if you even get close, Google's going to find it for you. And what's fascinating about this treaty, it looks like a lot of other covenantal treaties, but what's fascinating, it really gets close to looking like our Declaration of Independence. So there's a preamble, there's a middle, there's an end, there's a who's in covenant with who section to it. And I know Thomas Jefferson is supposed to have written our own Declaration of Independence, but I challenge anybody to go look at that treaty. Don't look at the language necessarily, but look at how it's constructed. And you'll see that Jefferson really had a look at this thing when he wrote the Declaration of Independence.
That is, and you were right on the spelling. It's A-R-B-R-O-A-T-H. We'll post that online. So for people who are, you know, listening in the car or whatever, and you don't
sure.
have a, you
it's
don't
an
have
amazing
a
document.
I think
and
that's
his name,
very cool.
Bruce's name is on it as okay. one of the principal nobles.
Yeah, 1320. We need to take a really quick break so we can put this online and thank our advertisers and do all that good stuff. We'll be back with Bill Hyde. And now that we've gotten into our topic, don't leave. He's not going to be holding his breath through this break, though. He needs all the oxygen so that he can do most of the talking. We'll be right back with you. You're listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR, 1460 AM.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped. Give a damn busted.
Love is like oxygen. You get too much, you get too.
So just in case our guest was holding his breath again.
How do you find this great music?
That's why we have Bob.
Hey, congratulations, Bob.
It's all about Bob.
What about Bob?
Gee. I know. It's his special magic.
A lot of people around here ask that question.
I think it's baby steps with Bob.
It's really nice, actually. We have some people who say, you know, I want to come back on again. I just want to see what kind of songs you guys pick. That's how we lure them in. That's the candy in our white van is Bob's music. all right. I forget where we were. We did Robert the Bruce. Help us, Bill.
Well, we were talking about the Declaration.
You were what?
I was babbling incoherently.
Oh, we like it.
That's where we were. Would you like more of that?
Yes, go do that.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, the Declaration of Arbroath is what we were talking about, the similarities between that and our own Declaration of Independence. But I always pictured Robert the Bruce as being kind of a torn individual. You know, he really wanted to do the right thing, and he just didn't have the guts to stand up and chance losing what he had by going against the king.
No, that is a great portrayal. I always try to look at those situations instead of throwing stones, the same way I look at you've had some great athletes out there in California, maybe, and Magic Johnson and Kobe and so forth, that have maybe done a few things that weren't the right thing, the same way we're talking about. But I always say to myself, I wonder how could I be Kobe Bryant? Could I stand the temptations of being Kobe Bryant? And then I start backing it back, and I say the same way. Could I withstand the temptations of being Robert the Bruce? And the truth of it is, I'm not sure I'd hold up in a situation like that, because I've never been tempted like that, and I don't know that I would automatically always make the right decision. So I'd like to think that I would, but I think all the listeners and people, you know, do we really know for sure that we're that strong? So there's always something to look at when a man makes a mistake, a woman makes a mistake, and say, how would I do if I were in their shoes? A little bit like the old Negro spiritual that used to say, it's not my mother or my father, my brother or my sister, it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer. I love that theology. Came from the cotton field, but it's a lot more sophisticated than stuff that comes out of a seminary, because what about me? It's not what about Bob, it's what about Bill? And I can tell you all the stuff that I think he did wrong, but I always say, how would I do?
Yeah,
you don't know. I mean, it's easy to look back and go, gosh, I would have held my ground. But, you know, you don't know if you were really there, would you? Would you choose to fight another day, or would you, you know, would that be the hill you die on? You know, you don't know until you're in that situation.
And the situation's gradual, meaning C.S. Lewis wrote this book about you know, being tempted and so forth, the Screwtape Letters, and he said, you know, the devil's never going to try to get you to kill your neighbor. He's going to first try to get you to be annoyed at the guy sitting behind you in church. You know, and so this idea of gradualism, I'm sure, had some effect on Robert the Bruce as well.
Oh, sure. Sure, because you have to weigh, you know, is this where I'll make the biggest difference, or if I wait and to fight another day, will I be able to implement some change in the meantime that'll be meaningful and maybe do more good by basically not doing the right thing at the time maybe you should have done it? it's a tough dilemma. You don't know what you would do.
It's a tough dilemma. I don't know if you guys know, I read an article the other day, if you do this, but Bruce, the character Bruce Wayne, was actually based on Robert the Bruce from the comic book. So that's kind of interesting history.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yes.
As in Batman?
That's another thing you could Google and read all kinds of interesting stuff about. Put in Bruce Wayne in quotes and Robert the Bruce in quotes, and you can Google and you hit the button and you get all kinds of good reading.
That is cool.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm doing it right now. It doesn't make for good radio, though.
It doesn't make for good radio, but can I talk about William Wallace for a second?
You know what? You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sky's the limit.
Can I sing? Can I sing?
Absolutely.
Well, hold on.
Let's
try that out the next break.
Let me tell you about Wallace for a second, to tell you the difference between how he was portrayed by Fran Mel and how he really was. We find out that in our research that when we really look at Wallace, we look at a guy who was went to a Christian school, had probably at least one uncle who was a priest. He had been given a Psalter when he was young. He kept that Psalter with him his whole life and read it all the time. And here's the kicker. Watch Braveheart, you get the idea that Wallace was a barbarian, and this is a revenge story. You know, you dirty rat, you killed my wife. But this is something much more. Wallace was an intellectual. Wallace spoke four or five languages. He had the ability to write letters to the Pope in Latin. He was an ambassador. He was someone that understood macroeconomics and microeconomics well. He was interested and took action to facilitate how trade was conducted and support cities. So he was a very different man than he was portrayed. And, of course, Mel Gibson wasn't that tall. William Wallace, they say, was 6'5", 6'6", 6'7", and had this huge sword is over there. I think he was every bit as big intellectually as he was physically. What's more, at the end of his life, when he had the opportunity to make a final request, Longshanks had captured him because of the betrayal of a friend, and he was in London, and horses hooked up to his arms and his legs, ready to pull him apart in four pieces, and he gets a last request with his last words after he's already been tortured beyond belief. He says, "Can I read my Bible as you're tearing me into four pieces?" Hmm. And so that's quite a thing, and it's quite an act of faith by someone, and it gives us a little different look at him than what we got through the movie, though I'm fond of the movie myself because I like that kind of, fond of the Scots, and I'm fond of Scottish history, and Wallace's place there, I think, really ends up having a big influence on how the Scots came over here later to this country and how we fought in the Revolutionary War against the British again. So the Scots are always leading the charges because the Scots generally are among the toughest people, and it's just the way it's been historically. I don't know if that's the way it is now, but I think that's the way it has been.
Well, I was just doing a little reading in here, and in History Today, it does have a thing in here about Bruce Wayne from Batman being modeled after Robert the Bruce.
Sure.
And Matt Anthony Wayne, an 18th century American general in the Revolutionary War. Here I'm thinking it's a cartoon, and they made the name up. Huh.
There you go.
I need to get out more.
You need to brush up on your Batman lore.
I do.
Yeah.
I need to brush up on my Robert the Bruce lore. That's really where
goes. But think about what the story that I told you about Robert the Bruce taking refuge in a cave, and then think about the Bat Cave, and it kind of comes alive even better, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I
mean, think about
it. I don't know that Robert the Bruce had Alfred.
That was the spider.
That was his spider. Nice. That is really clever, Bill. Thank you for that.
He's making notes. Interesting. So yeah. Okay, Wallace was a lot more, I guess, sophisticated might be overkill, but he really was more sophisticated than they portrayed him.
I would say he'd be sophisticated if he were on the phone with you today. I certainly don't speak five languages. I can't write letters to Pope in Latin. So I think if he were on the phone, you know, today we'll be speaking with William Wallace. I think he would be his language patterns would be very different, and you would have struggled to understand what he's saying, obviously, but the level of intelligence, the understanding of philosophy and metaphysics and ethics and all of those things, I think, in this man were very high.
Oh, sure. I mean, even today. I mean, if you spoke five languages today, it says a lot about your intellect and your education. But back in those days, speaking five languages.
Especially up there, because they were very cut off.
Yeah, they were a little bit isolated up there. And five languages, you'd be a well-traveled individual.
And the only people that could pull that off let's plug the Catholic Church again here. The only people that could pull this off is and make this the case is the Church. Protestants, yeah. Remember, there's no Protestant Church at this time. You know, the late 1200s and early 1300s. There's no. This is strictly great Catholic men and women and fearless people in the Church doing what they see as right. You might also, I find an interesting thing when sort of Charlemagne's people came north. They wanted these people in Scotland to behave in a certain way a little bit later in church protocol and polity as well. You're talking about people that were kind of tough. We're talking about a rare bird and highly educated with respect to Wallace, but you're talking about a people that would growl when they ate a lot of times, and you can imagine the church coming from Rome and having meetings with some of these Scots, what that would look like, and trying to found an agreed upon historic Catholicity based on people that growl when they eat and people that were kind of, probably were wearing perfume from Charlemagne's court. I mean, these are different types of people.
Oh, yeah.
Well, sure. If you look at history, the Scots were very well known as warriors in early history. They traveled around, and, if you wanted the dirty work done, you called the Scots. They came in and...
Or the Irish.
Took care of business.
Yeah, they had
no
problem.
Tough people.
Yeah, painting their face and, burning it all down. But there are a lot of... there's one really good book. The guy... Maybe you could redo this book, because I've always wanted to listen to the whole thing. But the guy is so boring. And it's How the Irish Saved Civilization.
Oh, it's a wonderful book.
It is an amazing book, but to listen to the audio is like, oh my gosh, it's painful.
Yeah. It's painful.
But it is that is a wonderful book, and that goes to the heart of this whole idea. They were so fierce, so far away. The weather was, untenable for a lot of those folks. And as the Romans went through and shredded everything, those guys kept a lot of our records.
Guess what happened when the Romans went in? You couldn't beat the Celtic people, the Scots and the Irish. And so instead of the Romans going in and conquering, they built a wall to keep the Scots out of the rest of Roman civilization. I mean, you've Hadrian's Wall. I mean, these are like the Romans really never ran into anybody until they ran into these people. And it literally scared them. Silly, and imagine building a wall to keep a people out. Because the Romans, I mean, think about the people, the Carthaginians, and all the people the Romans had fought and won against other barbarian groups in Germanic tribes and so forth. Right? We watched Russell Crowe in Gladiator, and we know that they fought all kinds of people. But when they got to these people, it was a whole different story. I'll tell you something. If we've got a second, I'll tell you a little story that I told in church today. I did a sermon today on how Silent Night affected World War I on Christmas Eve. I don't know if you guys know that story or not.
Before you go there, we do have to take one quick break, because I don't want to cut that short. We'll take a break and be right back with the Silent Night story. Because I think I know that story, and it's a great story.
Do you? Okay. You're listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR, 1460 AM. We'll be right back.
Singing songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love.
cool.
The old hurdy-gurdy.
The old hurdy-gurdy man. Boy, you know, kids would have to go look that up now. They wouldn't even know how to spell it, the hurdy-gurdy man. Oh, you're rejoining We the People Radio for another lovely Sunday morning right before Christmas. Merry Christmas, everybody, in case we run out of time at the end, which hardly ever happens, but just thought we better tell you. All right, Bill, back to you.
Yeah, we're going to talk.
It could happen with me. You could run out of time with me.
Yeah, yeah.
I would talk through the breaks.
Yeah, we're bad.
Into eternity.
We're all bad at that.
Anyway, well, I was going to tell you about Silent Night, and there's this story. It has everything to do with Scotland. It's kind of typical of the Scots. But so it's December 24th, and there's this long line in Belgium from Flanders on down, right? And you've got the Germans on one side, kind of fierce fighting, and the Brits on the other side. And the Germans start to put Christmas trees up, put candles on them, and light the candles. And the English, who are out on their mission, see this, a little confused by it. They think it's a kind of warfare or whatever. As they get closer and closer, they're creeping across wind and snow and rain and all this nonsense, and they're creeping across no man's land, and they see that it's finally Christmas trees. They hear people singing Silent Night. They start singing Silent Night with the Germans. Creates this amazing truce that spanned 27 miles that went down through where the Germans and Brits said, we'd like to bury our dead, we'd like to exchange some gifts. The Germans had chocolate cake, the English had pudding. All of those things went back and forth, and of course, these were Anglo-Saxons versus the Saxons, so in many ways they weren't so different. A lot of Germans had been in London acting as waiters and so forth, and were called back to Germany for World War I. So a lot of them had been actually living in England and were fighting. Anyway, they declared this amazing truce, and starting on Christmas Eve, and it lasts into Christmas Day, and leave it to a Scotsman to bring a soccer ball, and they actually played soccer on no man's land on Christmas Day. The Germans won 3-2, but it takes a Scot, right, to bring a soccer ball to trench warfare,
to a battlefield. Yeah, amazing. And I think there's pictures of there was actually photographs taken of
really
of that event. Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, another Google. Geez, we're telling everybody to go to computers, but you can go to Google and type in Silent Night Truce, go to Google Images, and you will see all kinds of pictures of people holding rats up that they've caught. They were even exchanging, I don't know if you're, Aaron, you're going to be preparing any rat meat for Christmas Day this year, but they were exchanging rat meat and all kinds of cigarettes and things that were, everything was scarce when you're fighting in trench warfare, and there's filth and disease everywhere. So it's quite a story, but that just so typical of the Scots and that indomitable attitude that they've had with Wallace. And we talked earlier about him kind of moving back as the British incursions into or English incursions into Scotland don't end here just because of Bannockburn. The persecutions continue in time, and a lot of Scots, you know, perhaps people that you know, or your family and friends, as a result of some of those incursions, came here. And they landed in the Mill Colonies, and then when the chance came to fight against the Hanoverian king, guess who the best fighters were in our Revolutionary War? There you go again. The Scots led the charge. And you take the Scots out of the equation, and you pretty much don't have independence for this country.
Yeah, and didn't you find it interesting here just recently when Scotland voted to separate from English rule, and the people voted to stay with England? I was really kind of surprised by that. I thought maybe this is it. Maybe this is when they're finally going to have their independence and have their own country. And they voted to stay with the UK, which was I don't know. I was kind of shocked.
I was over there when in the summertime, prior to the election, and interviewing people and talking to the people about it, and it was highly polarizing for them. Some people were extremely interested in liberty and were talking about liberty in terms of what we've been discussing today. Others had the attitude of Robert the Bruce, and so don't think just because, you live in a republic or something that more resembles something that's democratized, that you can't have this idea that you're holding on to something that you think you're going to lose. Most of the people that voted against that, independence, were thinking along the lines of Robert the Bruce, were thinking, not that it was life on the line here necessarily, because England wasn't going to attack them, but really I think a lot of the papers, when you read the papers in Edinburgh and so forth, the papers and the media are controlled by people that did not want to see this breakup occur, the banking industry and a lot of other places. And so there were no friendly headlines to independence in Scotland that I saw. Everything was kind of organized together and pitched about all the damage. And I think the scare tactics that the establishment used were enormous, just in the headlines and watching the news when I was there.
Uh-oh. Did we lose you? Are you still there?
Hello? No,
oh, there okay. we go. There was
hey, did you
noises.
Find did you find that there was a separation in the age groups on that whole issue? I kind of felt that maybe it was the younger folks that wanted to stay, and the older folks that probably knew a little bit more about history. And I don't know if the Scottish people are big on their heritage. But what did you find there? Was there a division there? As far as the age groups?
There was, and it's just exactly I would have expected exactly what you just described, Bill, but what I found was the opposite. I found the older people who felt like their pensions, here back to Robert the Bruce again.
Oh boy, yeah.
Felt like their pensions, were somehow
in jeopardy, yeah.
And so forth. They were very much for keeping things together, and it was the hippies, you know, the young people, I'd say 30, 40 and under.
Yeah.
They had fire in their belly, very much like some of their ancient ancestors had, but you could kind of tell by demographics today. It's like, if you look at, I'm 56 years old, and so the demographic that is my baby boomer group can easily outvote my kids group.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what happened too. I mean, you had people just saying, I don't want to lose my pension. And so mom and dad and grandpa they huddled down and said, too much to lose.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. That's exactly, I think, where Robert the Bruce was. I mean, it's, those ties were so strong. It must have seemed overwhelming to him to think of the change that would occur if they did separate.
And the old what if?
I think he probably saw, Longshanks as an ally in some cases too, because,
sure,
you know, he wasn't the only enemy in the world, right? There were other enemies in the world as well. England wasn't, quote unquote, you know, the only bad guy. There were other things from the night that could come and get you. And so I think he probably was concerned about, yeah, you know, just imagine being attached to, it's like someone today, imagine Canada deciding, you know, they don't want anything to do with us. There's such security, as crazy as our country's become, there's such security in kind of being anchored to us that it would be a tough one, I think, for Canadians to say, you know, we're not going to have anything to do with you. We're closing the borders and, you know, we're not trading with you. We're doing this or that.
Yeah, where would they go for their medical care? Oh, wait, no, that's over now.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, man, one more snarky comment. Okay, we have to take our very last break here. And, I guess we're taking it right now. And then we'll be right back. Finish out the hour with Bill Hyde. Because you're going to like it, go to the website, wethepeopleradio.us. You can find out everything about the audiobook. You're going to need copies, 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 copies to get them to folks. It's going to be awesome. Be right back with you in 2 minutes here at KCNR, 1460 AM.
Bombs. expansion started way earlier. The earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall.
We built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery, it all started with a big bang.
Boom!
I like that show too. I think it's funny. Oh, Bill Hyde. It's been quite a little,
it's been quite a ride.
Quite a little ride with you this morning, huh?
Well, it's been, it's been a lot of fun for me. It's fun. I mean, just like, I agree with what you're saying about Bob. I'm a believer, like Mickey Dolan said, you know, I'm a believer. I saw Bob's face with Bob's music. And so now I know what quick reactions are. And you have to be mentally, sort of quick to be able to jump into music like that. So it's kind of been fun for me.
It's super fun. That's how we find all you guys. Somebody has fun and then somebody tells somebody else, and then if my phone rings at 6 o'clock in the morning and they go, you got to have this guy on. I go, okay. It's awesome. So, you know, in the last 10 minutes here, or 8 minutes or whatever it is, tell folks about the audiobook. And let's not forget to, you know, get down to the brass tacks here. We got to do a little promoting.
Sure. Well, it's a two CD set, and I'm not actually really good at promoting it. I'm passionate about creating it, and I hope that people like it. But we actually call it an audio movie because we like the idea that we can create something where the child's brain, and this is something for families, but for children, especially, parents can listen to it too. You're going to get a lot of history, and you're going to have a lot of fun. But it's kind of written for, I would say, kids maybe 6 to 12, 13, 14, whatever. And then, of course, adults would enjoy listening in as well. But we think that kids today get too much screen time. We think the number is 55, 60 hours a week. And so I wanted to create a product that could actually help a child's imagination. I was interested in the development of the child's brain and just in thought. And so we wanted to do something that would help a child grow in a way that I think if you watch a movie, and I'm a movie watcher, but I think if you make that your kid's sole way of getting stories in, all the imagination, quote unquote, heavy lifting is done. And the child doesn't have to do any of it. So when you read a book or you listen to a compelling audio drama like this, what happens to the brain is something very different than if you watch the movie. You have chemicals being released in the brain. One that we're finding out now, a chemical that's being released when a child listens to a great story like this is called oxytocin. Not Oxycontin, not the Rush Limbaugh thing, but this is oxytocin. And it's a chemical that actually helps you learn. So people think, well, why when we hear something or why when we get engaged do we learn better? The beautiful thing about this is kids are going to listen to it. They're going to learn real history, and they're actually going to enjoy it. And for parents, that's kind of the fun part, because if you tell kids that you're going to learn something, they're going to recoil and rebuff and not want to be a part of it. But this is a new way of learning, and no one knows that they're learning anything because they're engaged in the story. But all of that's by design in our part. We wanted to make it fun, and we wanted to inculcate history. We love history, and we think that there's just work needs to be done on the history side to bring real Christian history back to life.
I think that's awesome.
That's right on the head, too, because I think that's there's a genuine vacuum when it comes to Christianity and our history. I think, speaking of Rush Limbaugh, the whole Rush Revere series he's doing, I think is touching on that, and he's been very successful with it. And I think this will be a big hit too, because kids learn through stories, and I think this is going to be perfect.
Well, that's why radio was always so great years ago, when you had all the before TV, and you had all the series that were on the radio, and everyone would listen, and they could make their own pictures in their head.
Yeah, you don't forget it when you learn it that way.
No, I'm a big,
well, you guys,
big
yeah,
fan.
Yeah. You said something interesting there, and it kind of triggered me back. Last year I was in Glenn Beck's office, and he was telling me, he's an old-time radio guy, so this has caught his attention too, and he loves, he says it's old-time radio, done really well. But when we were talking in his office, he said to me, he was telling me about listening to it with his son Rafe, and he said, Rafe was listening to it with me, and then he said, Dad, stop. And then, what? He goes, I'm going to draw a picture of Sir Francis Drake. So Rafe made Glenn stop the recording. He went and got some crayons and a blank piece of paper. He drew a picture for Glenn of what he thought Sir Francis Drake looked like. Now, that's exactly, Aaron, what you're talking about.
Yep.
And you know what? If that's all you get is one story or two stories like that, I would think that I've done my job because I've got someone to not just watch something, but for imagination to grow. And for parent, you know, the byproduct of that is, if everyone's listening carefully, is Glenn interacting with Rafe.
Yes.
Glenn talking to Rafe about the story and why he thinks Sir Francis Drake looks this way instead of that way. To me, that's just gold.
Absolutely. And that's also how kids learn to solve problems. That's why, I mean, I'm the oldest of five kids, and my dad's thing was always, you know, my mom is a cellist, so we listened to the Boston Pops all the time, and I'll never forget it. As I got older, it was annoying, but as a kid, we didn't know it was supposed to be annoying. He would make us all lay down on the floor, and then he'd turn the Boston Pops up really loud, and then my dad had a really loud voice.
Did you have to listen to Peter and the Wolf?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Yeah, a million times. But my dad would say, can't you hear it? Can't you hear it? This is what they're doing. And he would, like, tell a story, you know, while the music was going on. And close your eyes, you know, we'd all have to, you know, what do you see? And it just, I don't know, it's stuff they don't do anymore because everybody's going, that is so, no wonder you're so like this. That's how I got damaged. But I never went to therapy for it, though, because I kind of like it. And the older I get, the more I like it.
Yeah.
So good for you for damaging other children on into the future.
Yeah,
you're teaching them how to have fun, how to think. And
what a great way to learn.
Yeah, you know, have some history. Imagination. But it says in the thing here that I can't get back to because now my screen is dead. But it said in there that you guys have great sound effects and all that. So it isn't just an audio book, somebody just reading a story. It's, like, loaded with sound effects.
It is. In some cases, we've got 200 sounds stacked on top of each other.
Nice.
Just in one scene. And here's the cool thing. If you want to go to freedomscause.com, look at a couple of the trailers. One of them is when we're in Scotland. If you hear a door creaking in our production in Freedom's Cause, chances are it's the real door in the real castle where the
nice.
Real event took place and creaked. You can watch all that stuff on there. We have a lot of attention to detail. One of my heroes is Admiral Rickover. You know, the devil's in the details, right? And so this thing,
that's,
you're going to get
great.
An amazing, when you hear birds, the birds are from Scotland in this story. They're not, they'd be old like William Wallace's birds, but not those birds, but they're Scotland birds that are around the castles and battlefields and stuff, on and on and on. We've gone to a lot of great lengths to try to make sure the production's as real as we could possibly make it.
That is awesome.
Bill, thanks for coming on. You, this was a great interview, and heck, I learned a lot.
And a good Christmas story. So Merry Christmas to you, Bill.
Thank you, guys.
And
everyone,
wish a Merry Christmas to all our listeners out there. Have a good one.
You can find out more about the audiobook at infreedomscause.com. And you are listening to We the People Radio. We'll be back with you next week. Have a very Merry Christmas to the Bills, to the Bob. See ya.
Likewise, from KCNR, Shasta Redding.